Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be in a listen-only mode for today's presentation. Today's conference is being recorded. If there are any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Linda Feinberg. Ms. Feinberg, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Good day, and welcome to our call-in series designed specifically for arbitrators and mediators. Today, more than 1,500 of you have signed up to join our call, which again shows your very strong dedication to our arbitration and mediation program. George Friedman and I will conduct today's workshop. A lot has changed since our last call, so we will cover several topics, and this may extend our call to about 1:15. On today's call, we will discuss the following topics: consolidation of the NASD and NYSD regulation dispute resolution programs, and in particular, how it affects you as neutrals; a rule proposal to strictly limit dispositive motions, which we filed with the SEC this past Friday on November 2nd. Request for expungement and your very important role with respect to those requests. Changes we are making to our discovery arbitrator pilot. The problems resulting from unsigned uniform submission agreements by respondents. A new rule about party representation, which will become effective December 24th. Time permitting, we will end the workshop with a question and answer session, answering questions you previously submitted. If we don't have time to answer them, we will post the answers on our website. Just a reminder, audio recordings of previous workshops are available on our website at www.finra.org under Resources for Neutrals. Now I'm going to turn this over to George Friedman, who will address the recent consolidation of NASD and NYSD regulation arbitration programs.
Thank you, Linda. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority was launched on July 30, 2007, when NASD and the regulatory arm of the New York Stock Exchange consolidated. The arbitration programs are included in the consolidation. Now, that's not much of a big stretch. NASD had about 95% of all the arbitration case filings before that time. On August 6th, and there was a gap of a few days, on August 6th, the NYSD arbitration rules were extinguished except, and I underscore, except for cases pending at the former NYSD arbitration department. What does this mean for arbitrators? I'll discuss a bit what this means in terms of the rules consolidation, best practices, and also the consolidation of our neutral roster. I guess the best hint here for arbitrators is to look at the rules under which the case was opened. So let me just underscore that. Look at the rules under which the case was opened. This will impact how the case is run, and also, most importantly, your classification as an arbitrator if you happen to be on the former New York Stock Exchange or NASD panel. Here we go. Any cases filed with the NASD forum prior to August 6, 2007 will be administered under the NASD Code of Arbitration Procedure. Now, I didn't misspeak here. I mean the NASD Code of Arbitration Procedure. Until we complete our comparison of our rules with the NYSD rules, they'll continue to be called the NASD Code. So, anything that was in the NASD shop prior to August 6 will continue to be administered under those rules, under the NASD Code of Arbitration Procedure. Similarly, any case that had been filed with the former New York Stock Exchange Arbitration Department prior to August 6th, and there were about 350 or so cases that were pending on day one, any of those cases will continue to be administered under the NYSD rules. Now, the staff administering those cases are FINRA staff members. I'll talk a bit more about that later, but the second point to note here is any case filed at the NYSD prior to August 6th will continue to be administered under those rules. And finally, any case filed on and after August 6th will be administered by FINRA under the NASD Code of Arbitration Procedure. Hope that's clear. A little bit now on staffing issues. Many arbitrators I know are concerned about the staff members at the NYSD Arbitration Department and what happened to them. So to answer one of the questions we received, all 19, and I underscore all 19 of the former NYSE arbitration staff members who were in that forum on July 30th joined FINRA on July 30th and are now FINRA employees. About half of them, a little more than half, 10, continue to remain at the 20 Broad Street facility working under Karen Cooper Smith's supervision, and their job will be to run the 350 arbitration cases that were pending in that forum to a conclusion over the next year or so. So, second question, what happened to the rest of them? The roughly 8 staff members have been placed already in positions at what was then the NESD Arbitration Forum and is now the FINRA Forum at Liberty Plaza in New York City. So every NYSC staff member has a job and is now working for FINRA. Rules comparison. We're taking a look at the NYSC rules to glean the best of those rules and to consider putting them in the NESC Code of Arbitration Procedure. Now, you may remember on the last call, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the NESC Code of Arbitration rewrite. We spent 3 years or so getting the NESC Code rewrite approved. The rules are now in plain English, in logical order. We have a separate industry code, customer code, and mediation code. The Commission likes the rules, of course. They approve the rules. So when I'm starting over again, taking those rules as our template, we're examining and comparing the NYSC rules, and over the course of the next several months, we'll be evaluating what rules to add to the NESC rules. For example, NYSC used court reporters, NESC tape or digitally recorded hearing, and you know, under active consideration is whether to use court reporters, which would appear to be a superior form of service for the parties. So this process will run out for the next several months. Eventually, there will be a rule filing presented to the FINRA board and ultimately to the SEC for approval. Best practices is the second tranche. These are things not in the rules necessarily, but practices, things that the two organizations did prior to the consolidation. And again, we're looking at how best to serve our constituents. For example, we already added 5 new hearing locations that the New York Stock Exchange Arbitration Department had that NESC didn't. And those new locations are in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Clearwater, New London, Connecticut, and Rochester, New York, bringing the total of hearing locations to 73 throughout the country. Also, NYSE staff routinely monitored initial pre-hearing conferences, whereas any NYSE staff didn't, and we're actively considering adopting that practice as well. Third, we're integrating the rosters. There were about 300 arbitrators who were on the NYSE roster who were not on the NEC roster, and they've been invited to join our roster through a simplified process. There were about 1,300 arbitrators who already were on both rosters. Those of you out there who were dual arbitrators, as we refer to you, need to do nothing. If you're on the NEC roster, you've been moved over to the FINRA roster, you need to do nothing. And again, the 300 or so who were on New York's roster but not on ours will have already been invited to join our roster. And those of you out there, I encourage you to complete the simplified form and send it back to us. We're also merging the physical files and databases on the arbitrators, and we'll have that done by the end of the year. And, of course, we're integrating the training programs as well. Last, physical integration. We now have 5 regional offices. We've added the New York Stock Exchange, former New York Stock Exchange office at 20 Broad Street in Manhattan. I mentioned we have 73 hearing locations. We also have New York hearing room facilities now at 2 FINRA locations, one at 1 Liberty Plaza and the other, of course, at 20 Broad Street. Email systems have been integrated. We're in the process now of integrating the awards online programs as well. We've started adding New York Stock Exchange awards as well as other SROs that were absorbed over the years, like ARCA. That'll be an ongoing process completed by, I guess, the end of the year, but already some of those awards are on the FINRA website. And we've evaluated the New York Stock Exchange technology that was used to support its arbitration program to see how we can leverage some of those systems in FINRA's work. Summing up, rules comparison, roster integration, and best practices reviews are well underway. We're going to complete those probably in the first half of 2008, at least in terms of finishing our work. We intend to integrate the best of both dispute resolution programs. Again, a reminder, it'll be the NESC Code of Arbitration procedure until we're done with the rules comparison process. And finally, we're one organization, FINRA Dispute Resolution. Back to you, Linda, now on dispositive motions.
Thank you, George. A problem has arisen in our forum and has increased over the last 3 years, and that relates to the filing of dispositive motions, particularly in investor cases, before the investor has had an opportunity to present his or her case in chief. Frequently, such motions are filed several times, even after an initial denial by an arbitrator or arbitration panel. The problem is that these motions cause expense to investors, and they delay the merits hearings, even though they are denied in most circumstances. We have concluded from this that this is an unfortunate litigation tactic, and we have proposed a rule to deal with this situation. In September, I'm pleased to say, the FINRA Board of Governors approved amendments to the Code of Arbitration Procedure, both the industry code and the customer code, that will strictly limit dispositive motions. Shortly after, we published a notice to parties to remind the parties and you, the arbitrators, of the forum's current policy on dispositive motions while the proposed rule is under SEC consideration. That notice states clearly that dispositive motions are discouraged in the forum, and it articulates the elements of the proposed dispositive motions rule amendment and explains the current dispositive motions procedure as set forth in Notice to Members 0707. And all of those documents are, of course, available on our website at www.finra.org. It also reminds parties that filing frivolous dispositive motions may expose them to sanctions and may, in fact, be a violation of Conduct Rule 2110. On November 2nd, just last Friday, we filed the proposed rule with the SEC, and it is now available on our website. The next step is for the Commission to publish the proposed rule for public comment. Now, we do recognize that in certain very limited circumstances, it would be unfair to require a party to proceed to a hearing. However, as a general matter, investors expect to have the right to a hearing in a mandatory arbitration setting. The proposed revisions are designed to balance these objectives. They will ensure that investors will have their claims heard in arbitration in almost all circumstances by doing two things: significantly limiting dispositive motions filed prior to the conclusion of a party's case in chief, and by imposing stringent sanctions against parties for engaging in abusive practices under the rule. The proposed rule, in conjunction with proposed amendments to the eligibility rule, which were filed at the same time as the dispositive motions rule, will allow only three grounds on which a panel may grant a dispositive motion. One is a signed settlement or written release. The second is factual impossibility. And the third is the existing 6-year time limit on the submission of an arbitration claim, the so-called eligibility rule. When a respondent files a dispositive motion after the investor has had an opportunity to present his or her case in chief, these provisions would not apply. There are lots of other details to this proposed rule, as we spelled out in our notice to parties, and you can view these on our website. Again, that's www.finra.org. And in total, these other provisions are designed to limit severely the ability of parties to engage in an unfortunate litigation tactic, which has added to the cost and time of a process which is supposed to be much more efficient and much less costly than the court process. Until the dispositive motion rule filing is approved, Rule 12503 of the Customer Code and 13503 of the Industry Code will continue to govern all motions, including dispositive motions, except that a party's response to a dispositive motion will not be due until the panel sets a deadline for that response. However, we urge arbitrators in the interim to be very judicious in considering motions to dismiss if they are filed before an investor or an associated person completes its case in chief. As I said, most such motions are denied in any event, but you all need to be mindful that they are expensive to respond to and only delay the merits hearing. We can only rely on you as the arbitrators in our forum to help us restrict this litigation tactic when non-meritorious dispositive motions are filed. Another issue that our forum has confronted, and in which you play the most critical of roles, relates to requests for expungement of CRD records. And I'll turn this back to George to discuss the rule and what role you play with respect to that rule.
Thanks, Linda. In late 2003, NASD Rule 2130 was promulgated, and it went into effect in April 2004. It established standards for expunging customer dispute information from the Central Registration Depository, known to most of you as CRD. As Linda mentioned, arbitrators play a hugely important role in the expungement process. Now, this probably seems familiar. We've covered this before on some of these calls. And, of course, we had mandatory training for all arbitrators after the rule became effective in early 2004. So 3 years later, it's time for a refresher. We thought we'd go through some of the elements of Rule 2130, and then I'll close with some developments of interest. First, Rule 2130, and it's NASD Rule 2130, not the Code of Arbitration Procedure. NASD Rule 2130 governs cases filed on and after April 12, 2004. So that's the magic date, April 12, 2004. And basically, it provides that a party can seek expungement either directly from a court or from the arbitrators as part of the award. Now, if arbitrators grant an expungement request, the party then has to ask a court of competent jurisdiction to confirm the arbitration award. It also has to name FINRA as a party. FINRA does have a procedure for waiving the obligation to be named as a party, and basically will review whether the arbitrators have complied with the requirements of Rule 2130 in ordering expungement. That leads to the next question, which is, what are those requirements? And this is very important for arbitrators to keep in mind, because from our perspective, it's an unfortunate thing if arbitrators intended to order an expungement but ineffectively did so because they didn't meet the requirements of Rule 2130. In order for your expungement order to be effective, the award has to contain one of three specific grounds as provided in the rule. The first is that the claim, allegation, or information is factually impossible or clearly erroneous. That's the language in the rule. Factually impossible or clearly erroneous. My plain English translation is, it may have happened, but this individual couldn't have been involved. For example, the complaint said that George Friedman committed these acts in 2006, when in fact George Friedman didn't join the firm until 2007, it's probably impossible that I could have been involved at that point. Or a wrongly identified broker, got the name wrong. So again, claim, allegation, or information is factually impossible or clearly erroneous. Second one is that the registered person wasn't involved in the alleged related sales practice violation, forgery, theft, misappropriation, or conversion of funds. And again, my plain English take on that is something may have happened, but this person wasn't involved. And that's the second ground. And then the third is that the claim, allegation, or information is false. Didn't happen. The award must specifically state one of those three grounds. So if an arbitrator says, I find a basis for expungement and stops there, the award will not be effective for an expungement to actually take place. You must articulate one of the three grounds. Now, the thing to bear in mind is that expungement is an extraordinary remedy. The CRD system is relied on by lots of people, by the general public, by investors who are considering whether to do business with a broker, by firms who are considering whether to retain or hire a broker, and by regulators. So this is an important artifact, an important system, and arbitrators play a key role. So the mere fact that you're denying a claim against the broker is not by itself a basis for ordering expungement from CRD. You must find one of those three grounds. I'm sorry, I'm repeating it so many times, it's very important. Now, sometimes parties settle a case, and ask arbitrators to embody the terms of the settlement in an arbitration award. That's okay. The particular item or term is a stipulated award. The parties can stipulate to a settlement and ask arbitrators to enter an award embodying the terms of the settlement. When that happens in expungement, however, there are certain things we strongly urge you to do. One is we strongly urge and encourage arbitrators to have a hearing. And the purpose of the hearing, and it can be a telephonic hearing, is to ascertain that expungement is in fact appropriate and that one of the three grounds I just mentioned at length and repeatedly is present. So we encourage, strongly urge arbitrators to have a hearing. You can do it by phone. And it's appropriate and it's okay for arbitrators to ask to see the settlement agreement. If a case is being settled and, for example, there's a large monetary payment being made to the customer, you might ask questions like, well, how is that, you know, how am I ordering expungement when, in fact, a large payment is being made to the customer? There may be an explanation, but it's okay and appropriate to ask. Third thing to keep in mind is that the Code of Ethics for Arbitrators, which you all have agreed to abide by, right before you sign your application to become a FINRA arbitrator, there's a provision that says, among other things, you agree to abide by the Code of Ethics for Arbitrators. Canon 5D says that arbitrators shouldn't sign a stipulated award unless they're satisfied with the propriety of the award. So I don't know how you satisfy yourself unless you actually go through the process of having the parties convince you that the settlement is appropriate and that you, in fact, should sign, that the expungement, rather, is appropriate and that you should sign. Anyway, after about 3 years, we're considering changes to Rule 2130. We'll go through the normal process of taking these proposed changes to the FINRA board. I can't tell you what they are at this point, what those changes are, and of course, the normal rule filing process with the commission. Finally, we're asked if the expungement rule is working, and, you know, at a high level, the answer is it would appear to be working. Just looking at the numbers in 2005, when the bulk of expungement orders actually executed into the system, expungement actually executed in the CRD system. 2005, there were 907, and the overwhelming number of those were pre-Rule 2130 cases. Let's start with 907. Then the world begins to bite. In 2006, there were 516. 2007, for the half-year mark, there were 166, and the bulk of those are 2130 cases, more than half. And if you extrapolate those numbers, there'll be about 332 by the end. So a couple of years ago, before the rule was fully effective, of course it was in effect, but before the majority of expungement orders came out of that rule, there were 907, and now we're projecting 332. So at a really high level, the number of expungements actually entered into the system would appear over this couple of year period to be down to a third of what they were. That's it on expungement. I'll turn it over to Linda now to talk about the Discovery Arbitrator Pilot Project.
A couple of years ago, we started experimenting with what we have called a Discovery Arbitrator Pilot. And we have mentioned this to you before, and it has been discussed in the Neutral Corner. We did this in response to requests both from investor lawyers and lawyers who represent broker-dealer firms about the discovery process moving slowly and becoming more court-like and somewhat burdensome. Under this program, which is voluntary, all parties must agree, we have created a roster of arbitrators who specialize in discovery matters. We are running this program right now in both our southeast and our western region. The discovery arbitrator, as you know, the authority of that arbitrator ceases with the commencement of the merits hearing. But that arbitrator, when selected by the parties, will consider all discovery matters up until the start of the merits hearing. We started this program in August of 2005. And due to feedback from the parties, we will be expanding it in three significant ways. First, we are extending the program until December 31st, 2009. Second, the program will now be nationwide. That is, it will be expanded to include both our Northeast and our Midwest regional offices.
And third, currently all of the arbitrators on our discovery arbitrator roster are public arbitrators. We will expand the roster to include non-public arbitrators to serve on intra-industry cases. That is, those intra-industry cases which otherwise would have a panel of three non-public arbitrators. If you watch our website, you will find current information when we announce the program, and we will also include that announcement in the neutral corner. That will take place after we recruit the arbitrators for the Northeast and the Midwest regions. We are in the process of doing that now and vetting those proposed candidates, and they will be trained by FINRA, dispute resolution staff, as well as lawyers who represent investors and lawyers who represent the industry. We are hoping that with these changes, we will find that more parties are willing to undertake this voluntary program, which has been very, very effective for those parties who, in fact, have elected to use it. George is going to now turn our attention to another problem which has, again, become somewhat significant in our forum, and this relates to firms and APs when they are respondents not signing the Uniform Submission Agreement, a document which is particularly important. Again, we have to rely on you, our arbitrators, to make sure that these agreements are signed by the respondents. George?
Thanks, Linda. What I'd like to do is do a little bit of review of what the code currently provides and then talk about what you as arbitrators can do to help us with the problem. What does the code provide? At the start of a case, the claimant must complete and sign a uniform submission agreement. They must. FINRA will not open an arbitration case without a signed uniform submission agreement from the claimant. The industry party under the Code of Arbitration Procedure has 45 days to complete and sign a uniform submission agreement. Now, if the industry party doesn't sign the uniform submission agreement, we still administer the case under the code, primarily under the industry party's obligation to arbitrate under the code upon the demand of the customer. So one might wonder, therefore, why is FINRA concerned about the problem if the net effect is that FINRA will still administer the case under the code. We are concerned. In fact, we've checked, we've done our own research, and our own assessment shows that several firms are not signing USAs in a significant percentage of the cases. Why the concern? Two issues. One, first, I guess, would be enforcement issues in terms of enforcing the arbitration awards. The Federal Arbitration Act and state arbitration laws typically require that the arbitration agreement be submitted with the arbitration award when a party seeks to enforce the award. In some states, there are problems that have arisen where the arbitration agreement in the customer broker agreement is inconsistent with the terms of the Code of Arbitration Procedure. So that's one potential problem, award enforcement. The second is fundamental fairness. Again, I said at the beginning of my remarks here that we simply will not start a case unless the customer signs the Uniform Submission Agreement, and it just doesn't seem fair that that same obligation isn't strictly enforced against the firm. And the third is because the code requires it. The Code of Arbitration Agreement, Code of Arbitration Procedure clearly requires industry parties to sign a Uniform Submission Agreement. Let me back up a bit and talk about some steps we've taken to date and then talk about what arbitrators can do to remedy the situation. In February 2004, we issued Notice to Members 04-11. And the notice to members reminded firms of their obligation to sign uniform submission agreements, and then it had a rather ominous warning, which I'll quote. Absent a specific and colorable objection that the respondent is not subject to arbitration, a respondent's failure to file a USA in a timely manner can lead to sanctions by the arbitration panel, and in certain circumstances may be considered a violation of just and equitable principles of trade, and NASB Rule 2110. So, 2004, over 3 years ago, we gave a fairly clear signal that this was a problem and that we intended to do something about it. And what can arbitrators do to remedy the situation right now? One of the changes we made following the 2004 initial pre-hearing, 2004 notice to parties, was to change the initial pre-hearing conference script. And by the way, this is available on our website. In the script, FINRA reminds arbitrators to remind the parties of their requirement to sign uniform submission agreements. And by the way, you can do this at the hearing as well. It doesn't hurt to do a reminder to make sure the document is in the file. The initial pre-hearing conference script also reminds parties that under the code, a panel may sanction a party for failure to comply with any provision of the code, and of course that includes the provision of the code requiring an industry party to sign a uniform submission agreement. We talk about sanctions. What are possible sanctions? I'll go through some of them. One is assessing monetary penalties payable to one or more of the parties. Second, an arbitrator can preclude a party from presenting evidence if the provision of the code is violated. Third, arbitrators can draw an adverse inference against the party. Fourth, arbitrators can assess postponement of forum fees against the party that violates the code. Fifth, arbitrators can assess attorney's fees, costs, and expenses. Arbitrators, at the conclusion of the case, may refer to the FINRA Enforcement Department's possible disciplinary action caused by an industry party's failure to abide by the code. So there are some hefty sanctions that arbitrators can meet out. Next step. If none of this works, then we're going to consider other steps. And this is reminiscent of what we did to curb discovery abuses a few years ago. One step is recommending enforcement actions against firms that habitually fail to sign uniform submission agreements. And of course, the second is rulemaking to tighten this up. So this is on our radar screen. It's an important initiative for us, and you as arbitrators can help right now. Linda will now cover the new party representative rule.
Well, thank you, George. There have been a lot of changes in the law and activity with respect to who can represent a party in the arbitration forum, which is, after all, a national forum. We proposed, and on September 26th of this year, the SEC approved a rule that addresses two things, non-attorney representation and multi-jurisdictional practice, that is, representation by out-of-state attorneys in our FINRA arbitration program. This rule, which will be effective on December 24th. With respect to non-attorney representation, under the rule, a party may be represented in arbitration by a person who is not an attorney unless one of three circumstances pertains. First, if state law prohibits such representation, and a number of states have adopted specific laws prohibiting representation by non-attorneys in the arbitration forum. Second, if the person is currently suspended or barred from the securities industry in any capacity, then that person may not represent a party in our arbitration forum. Or third, the person is currently suspended from the practice of law or disbarred from the practice of law. These provisions have been designed to protect parties and particularly to protect public investors. The other part of the rule deals with multi-jurisdictional practice as follows. Of course, at any stage of an arbitration proceeding held in the United States hearing location, all the parties have the right to be represented by any attorney who is in good standing and admitted to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States or the highest court of any state of the United States, the District of Columbia, or any commonwealth or territory, unless state law prohibits such representation. In other words, our rule is not designed to preempt state law in this area, which has been specifically handled by the states for many, many, many years. The rule will be prospective. That is, it will not affect current representation in the forum. Those parties who are represented by non-attorneys, for example, in the forum on December 24th can continue to the conclusion of that case.
We will issue a regulatory notice spelling all of this out, and that will be followed by the December 24th effective date. And as I said, that rule will be prospective. We believe it's an important rule to protect investors and to make sure that they have the kind of representation to which they're entitled in the arbitration forum. I see that we have some time for looking at case filing statistics and trends and how that may affect you as arbitrators.
Thanks, Linda. At the top of the news, filings are down. This shouldn't come as a shock to anyone. We've studied this situation and concluded that people fight less when they're making money. But really, that observation is absolutely accurate. Our business tends to be countercyclical to the market. As capital markets improve, the number of arbitrations filed will decline, and vice versa. So, not surprisingly, filings are down. We had these stats are on any FINRA's webpage, www.finra.org. We had 4,614 cases in 2006. That was a 24% decline compared to 2005, and that trend continues. In fact, it's somewhat accelerated for this year. So through October, our filings are about 34% less than last year, and again, last year was less than the year before. You can see the picture that's emerging. And we're trending to have a little over 3,000 cases this year. If the current case filing trend continues. Not surprisingly, the high watermark for case filing was 2003, when we had 8,943 cases in the wake of the 2000 market adjustment and the analyst problems that followed thereafter. So doing the math, from the high watermark of nearly 9,000 cases, well, we're down almost half. In fact, through this year, it's more than half. So although it appears the filings have bottomed down for reasons we'll discuss a bit later. Now, what's interesting is the raw number of industry cases has stayed the same, pretty much the same over the past several years. So as the customer cases have declined in number, the percentage of our business, of our case filings that arise from industry disputes has gone up, and they're now to about a third now of the cases. So now roughly 1 in 3 arbitrations that come across our portal are industry cases. Again, it's the fact not that there are more cases, but the overall number has stayed the same while the number of customer cases has declined. Another interesting trend is more cases are settling and less are being decided by arbitrators. If you look back, let's say, 5 years ago, about a third of the cases that were filed ultimately got decided by arbitrators. Last year, that number declined to about a quarter. So now, roughly one in four cases will be decided by arbitrators, and the rest are settled either through mediation or direct party action or through other methods, or in fact maybe withdrawn, but the bulk are settled. And that the percentage that are being settled, of course, has gone up as the number decided by arbitrators has gone down. The so-called win rate, and that's not a term we use, but the percent of cases in which the customer gets a monetary recovery has declined. It was 42% last year. Not terribly surprising. It was driven by a couple of things. For one, our friends and colleagues in the enforcement department have done a really good job getting bad guys out of the business, to use a technical term. And some of the bucket shop bad firms have been driven out of the business by NASD and now FINRA. So that has led to a decline in so-called win rate, and also there were about 2,000 analyst cases filed in the wake of the analyst problem in the early part of this decade, and investors fared very poorly, either in the arbitration forum or for that matter, in court, and that's also driven down the so-called win rate, which we never use. Cases are moving faster, with processing times are actually down across the board last year and compared to 5 years ago. And we're proud of that because we look to the process and how we run it. This is, after all, what we do. Our job is to administer the cases. And also thank you as arbitrators for adhering to some of our helpful guidance, such as scheduling hearings promptly after initial pre-hearing conferences. We're not calling a market bottom in terms of case filing, but you read the same news we do. There's been market volatility, certainly, over the past several months. There have been issues making headlines that you've all read about in terms of hedge funds or subprime mortgages, no predictions on what that's going to do. But it would appear, going back to that adage I mentioned at the beginning, you know, when people are not making money, they tend to fight more. So it would appear as though we've bottomed out and returned to historical case filing trends, or pretty much where we were in 1997-98 before the market declined in 2000 and then the analyst problem. So that's what's going on in terms of the statistics, and I'll turn it back to Linda for the question and answer section.
A number of you submitted questions prior to this session, many of them related to the dispositive motions rule, and I think we've answered most of those. We'll answer some of the others now, and if your question is not answered, we will answer it on the Ask FINRA portion of our website at a later date. First, a question from an arbitrator. Is there any truth to the rumor that FINRA arbitrations will be replaced by sending all disputes to the court system? There's absolutely no truth to this rumor. And rather than my just stating that, let me give you some facts which demonstrate that. I guess first and foremost, our regulator, the Securities and Exchange Commission, requires that every market that is an SRO, that is a self-regulatory organization, and any other self-regulatory organization, which is what FINRA is, provide an arbitration forum for investors. We provide such a forum not only for FINRA, but also for the New York Stock Exchange, for NASDAQ, for the American Stock Exchange, for the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, for the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, and for the International Securities Exchange. So there really is no way that we could close up shop and decide to send all of these cases to court, nor do we think it would be good for investors. Second, and I guess that's my second point, we see the arbitration and mediation forums as a service to the investing public and to broker-dealer firms. We provide a less expensive, more efficient way for investors and firms to resolve their disputes, or for firms to resolve disputes with other firms or with employees. We believe it is important to continue to provide this service to the investing public. And third, we are in the process of a huge capital investment in the FINRA arbitration and mediation program. Our computer processing, case servicing, list selection are undergoing massive changes in what we have called Matrix. That's the new acronym for what will be our new computer system. We are about two-thirds finished with this process, which has now been going on for 3 or 4 years, and we hope to be totally completed by 2009. And we have been bringing in each part of the matrix release on time or under time, and on budget or under budget. We would not be making that kind of a financial commitment and a resource commitment in the area of technology if we were not going to maintain the arbitration and mediation forum. And I guess finally I might point out that we are a significant part of the NYSE FINRA consolidation. Rule filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission made clear that the arbitration was part of this consolidation. So that's an emphatic no to the question, is FINRA arbitration going to be replaced by sending all disputes to court? I was asked a question about frivolous motions and frivolous dispositive motions that I did not cover in my prior remarks. And this is from an arbitrator who wants to know whether parties who file frivolous dispositive motions may be exposed to sanctions. And there are two questions here. Can panels currently issue sanctions for the filing of a frivolous motion? And what types of sanctions may a panel impose? The answer to the first question is absolutely yes. Panels may currently and should issue sanctions against a party for filing a frivolous motion. In response to the second question, the sanctions are numerous and varied, but not limited to assessing monetary penalties, precluding a party from presenting evidence, making an adverse inference, As George indicated with respect to uniform submission agreements, assessing postponement or forum fees, and assessing attorney's fees, costs, and expenses. Now, in addition, as is true with other rules that are not followed, panels may initiate disciplinary referrals at the conclusion of an arbitration. So yes, panels are definitely empowered to issue sanctions in response to frivolous motions, no matter what type of motion that is. And one of the things that the new codes do is to really make much clearer the arbitrator's authority to issue such sanctions. And finally for me, before I turn it back to George, a more technical question relating to the rule that will become effective December 24 with respect to non-attorney representation. And the question has to do with a partnership in which the non-attorney representative is a partner. And the question is whether that partner will be able to represent the partnership. And the answer to that question is also yes. The recently approved amendments to Rules 12-208 and 13-208 will codify the current practice and state in pertinent part that a member of a partnership may represent the partnership. And now I'll turn it over to George for some other questions.
Thanks, Linda. I had a couple of questions that came in. One, I guess to follow up on my comment on case filings and trends. And the question from an arbitrator is as follows. Many of us have trained long and hard to assume the responsibilities of chairperson or panel member. While we realize that volume is down, we are disappointed that we're not serving very often. Why is that? What does it take to be placed on a panel? I guess to begin with, and we can't say it often enough, we want to thank each and every one of you for your service. We know you've trained, and we simply cannot function as a forum without you. I guess there are a couple of factors to consider. That I guess answer the first question, why are arbitrators being appointed last? A couple to consider, and then I'm going to mention a few things that U.S. arbitrators might do to increase your chances, perhaps, of being selected. A couple of things to consider. As I mentioned before, we have had steadily declining cases since the high water mark a few years ago. So for the past 4 years, the number of cases has declined. And as I mentioned, we're about half where, in terms of case filings where we were before. And that's, by the way, the New York Stock Exchange had the same experience with this forum. So, I have to tell you, that means there are fewer cases that we need to have panels for, fewer lists of arbitrators for us to send to parties, and therefore fewer opportunities for arbitrators to be selected. The second factor, I think, to consider is, under the Code of Arbitration procedure, and it's been that way since 1998, we offer the parties the opportunity to select arbitrators. One of the changes we mentioned the last time we spoke to you earlier this year when we had one of these calls was the following change in the Code of Arbitration procedure. We now send out, in a three-arbitrator case, three lists containing a total of 24 names, 8 public arbitrators, 8 non-public arbitrators, and 8 public chair-qualified arbitrators. It's 24. At the end of the day, only 3 of those folks are going to serve. So my shorthand for this is many are listed but fewer chosen. Just look at the odds. 24 names coming out, only 3 are serving. And by the way, another change we made under the when we rolled out the Code of Arbitration procedure on April 16th of this year, any list we generate after that date is comprised randomly. So when the system goes looking for those 24 names, it's doing a random selection. Now, what can you do about this? Well, parties are empowered under the Code of Arbitration procedure to pick arbitrators. The first thing we'd recommend you do is you regularly look at and update your arbitrator disclosure report. Our neutral roster department would be happy to do that. And if you ask them for a copy of your report, we'll give it to you and we'll work with you to make improvements. Second thing you might do is consider taking training programs. FINRA offers training programs. Some are mandatory, as you know, which is expensive, and others are not. But parties look to things like that in deciding whether they have the competence to select that arbitrator. And I guess the third thing to do, and it goes back to the point I made before, is to be patient. Our business is cyclical, and we think we're fairly close to a low water mark in case filings, and as the case filings go up, of course, the opportunities to be selected go up as well. We can't guarantee that parties will select you. I can't guarantee that your names are going out on a random basis under the new Code of Arbitration procedure. And again, recognize there are things you can do to make your biographical information more attractive. The second and last question I got pertains to settlement. The question was as follows. When settlements are reached, the arbitrators are not informed of the results. Is FINRA informed, and are the parties' records so noted? I assume that means the industry's parties' records so noted. If not, it seems as though the public is not being informed of actions taken against the parties. Well, let me break that out a couple of ways. The first part of the question, are arbitrators being informed? Well, to some extent, that's up to you. As I mentioned before, as an arbitrator, if it's a settled case, and certainly a settled case calling for expungement, and you're asked to embody that settlement in the stipulated award. I mentioned before, it's appropriate for you to ask to see the settlement agreement. So in those instances, of course, you would. Sometimes the parties settle, and they don't ask us to have the arbitrators enter a stipulated award, and then the answer to the question is, no, we're not provided. FINRA is not provided with a copy of the settlement, and therefore you as arbitrators would not know. However, the third part of the question, which is the public not being informed, there is a requirement that the Form Q4 and Q5 be updated to reflect settlements for $10,000 or more. So the public, and this of course feeds into the CRD system and FINRA's broker check program as well, that's available on our webpage. So if there's a settlement, again, involving $10,000 or more, the record of that industry party will be updated to so reflect. Linda, I think that was it for questions. So
that's correct.
I'm ready to wrap up. One reminder I've been asked to make, the new code, as I mentioned, went out and became effective April 16th as mandatory training for arbitrators. Some of you, not very many, most arbitrators were happy to say have completed the training, but if you haven't done so, you've probably received a gentle reminder, maybe not so gentle, to complete the training, which is free, I should mention. And available on our website, so I'd encourage you to do that if you've not completed the training. On logistical matters, an audio file of today's program will be available on the dispute resolution part of FINRA's webpage. And again, you go to www.finra.org, and then across the top you'll see several subject areas. One of them is arbitration and mediation. That's the one you want to collect, and you'll be taken to our part of the webpage. So fairly soon we'll have an audio up there. We're contemplating looking at some newer technology for delivering content to arbitrators, such as podcasts or webcasts. My children have convinced me that it's a good idea to do that, and so we'll be evaluating those as well. We're planning our next call for early in 2008, at which point we'll update you on the case filing statistics and other changes, including the status of the motions to dismiss rule at that point. Linda and I and all of the officers and staff of FINRA Dispute Resolution want to thank you for your service and dedication. We cannot do this job without you, and we thank you for that. And we wish you all a happy Thanksgiving and happy holidays.
We are finished now.
Thank you. And thank you for joining today's conference. That does conclude the call at this time. You may disconnect.